with Progressive International and other groups, are leading a land, sea, and air humanitarian solidarity mission to Cuba later in March. We'll link to your new article, Suffocating an Island, What the U.S. Blockade is Doing to the People of Cuba. Coming up, an 11-month investigation by Forensic Architecture and Earshot has uncovered how Israeli forces killed 15 Palestinian aid workers a year ago, then tried to cover it up. Back in 30 seconds. City Palestinian Youth Choir performing Unadikom, I Call Out to You, at the historic Riverside Church. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Gaza, where almost 1 year ago, Israeli forces killed 15 Palestinian medics and aid workers in a sustained two-hour attack on a rescue convoy and then attempted to cover it up. The soldiers buried 14 bodies in a shallow mass grave and crushed the rescue vehicles with heavy machinery. The ambush took place in the early hours of March 23, 2025, in the area of Tel El Sultan in southern Gaza. Those killed include 8 aid workers with the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, 6 Palestinian civil defense workers, and a UN relief agency staffer. The independent research groups Forensic Architecture and Earshot have painstakingly recreated a minute-by-minute accounting of what took place. The 11-month investigation draws on audio and video recordings from the scene, open source and satellite imagery, and the in-depth testimony of 2 survivors. This is a clip.
To give you an idea, it was still dark. We crossed the ambush site without noticing the vehicle. Then we met Saleh and Ashraf's ambulance at the Iqlimi crossroad.
Forensic Architecture built a 3D model based on the testimony and available visuals, while Earshot used echolocation to analyze the more than 900 shots fired. They concluded that Israeli forces were in an elevated position when they began firing, then moved towards the aid workers while continuously firing. Paramedic Rafat Radwan was recording on his cell phone from inside one of the vehicles when the attack started, showing the ambulances had their lights on when the attack started, contradicting Israel's initial claim that the convoy had approached suspiciously with their lights off. The sounds of Israeli gunfire were recovered when Rawan's cell phone was found after his body was exhumed. For more, we're joined by 2 of the investigators. Samane Mwafi is Assistant Director of Research with Forensic Architecture, and Lawrence Abu Hamdan is the founder and director of Earshot. He's been described as a private ear rather than a private eye for his work as an audio investigator, was recently profiled by The New Yorker magazine. They're both joining us from London. Samane, why don't we start with you? Tell us about the day, what happened, what was understood at the time, and then what you found as you dissected what took place.
On the day, at shortly before, there is an airstrike in Al-Hashashin. Two Red Crescent ambulances are sent to rescue those who are injured, and one of them loses contact. So time passes. The Red Crescent sends more ambulances to search for the lost ambulance, and then they're joined by the civil defense, by a civil defense ambulance and a fire truck, and they find the missing ambulance. They approach it, and then upon approaching, they're shot at again. Our investigation brings and kind of shows a detailed analysis of what exactly took place, minute by minute, from the beginning to the days and weeks and months that follow.
And Samine, could you also talk about the broader context in which this incident occurred, what the situation was in Gaza at the time when this incident occurred, March 23rd last year, 2025?
Of course. So a ceasefire had begun in January in Gaza on the 19th of January. On the 18th of March, the ceasefire is broken by a series of nighttime airstrikes by the Israeli military. About 400 Palestinians are killed in these nighttime strikes. We have on the 20th of March leaflets dropped by the Israeli military across Gaza with genocidal messages. The incident, this airstrike in Al-Hashashin, happens on 23rd of March, right? So 5 days after the break of the ceasefire by the Israeli military. The attack happens on one of the ambulances. Then it's followed by a kind of like an attack and an execution of a convoy of rescue workers who come searching for the missing ambulance. And then I can kind of like, I can also say what happens after, right? Immediately, around kind of like, so we've been able to show that the attack continues for over 2 hours. So until 7 a.m. in the morning, where we have the last recording of the night, we can hear sounds of shooting, right? At about 8:30 a.m., leaflets are dropped in Tel Sultan, telling people to evacuate their homes. At this time, we also have a series of kind of like earthworks beginning on this area. So we have the construction of pits that then are used for interrogation. We have the construction of checkpoints on the very same road. We have the burying of the bodies, and we have the burying and crushing of the ambulances and the emergency vehicles. By this point, two UN vehicles had also arrived on site and were also attacked. One of the two survivors of the incident from the Red Crescent, Munzer Abed, was used as what he described as a kind of a human tool to monitor the checkpoint, to do the work for the Israeli military, to separate Palestinian men from women, and then put the ones that are that the Israelis are saying into interrogation pits. And so that's kind of like, that's the early hours, right? We see these, the construction of these earthworms at a satellite image that is available from 11 a.m. on that morning. Now, if we pass, so kind of like what follows is a destruction of a clearing of Tel Sultan neighborhood of Rafah. And then what we have is a kind of a turn, right? So we have the militarization of aid. So by this point, there has been months that no aid is entering Gaza. And we have a kind of like a construction of four sites for distribution of aid. But of course, what they're doing is luring Palestinians in so that they would be killed again. One of these aid distribution sites is actually constructed right by the site of the massacre and the execution of aid workers in Tel Sultan.
I want to bring Lawrence Abu Hamdan into this conversation. It's an amazing story. The crushing of the ambulances and burying them. to hide what had taken place. But Lawrence, can you explain the role of your organization, Earshot, in analyzing the gunshots, what exactly took place, what you found, how many shooters, their locations? Again, you've been called, rather than a private eye, a private ear.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. So, you know, this is a classic case for an organization like Earshot. We do audio analysis for human rights and environmental advocacy. And when we have a case like this where the evidence is really heard but not so much seen, right, because the main piece of evidence that was taken by Rifat Ridwan, he was holding the camera to his chest as he was covering from the gunfire. And so you see very little, but you hear almost everything that happens, and you hear it in stereo. So what we could do is, over 11 months, analyze each of those gunshots and sort of piece together the whole story of what happened. What we found out is that they start firing from an elevated position where the vehicles would have been in full view, about 40 meters to the southeast of Rifat's position. Then they begin advancing after about 4 minutes of gunfire. This is really intense gunfire. So, you know, in those first 5 minutes, you're talking about 850 shots fired. Towards the last minute and 30 seconds of that video, the Israeli soldiers walk in as they're firing. They move at a walking pace of about 1 meter per second, and then they arrive at the position of the aid workers. There we start to hear new echoes that we don't hear on the rest of the recording. Those are the echoes reflecting off the ambulances themselves, indicating that the soldiers are in and amongst the ambulances as they're firing at the aid workers for the last shots. These are when the video cuts, and we assume these are the moments of the execution. They're within meters of the aid workers. And actually, our analysis could go one step further, is that by sort of looking at the orientation and the organization of the ambulance around the shooter, we could see which was the most likely one that was producing each echo, right? So each shot produced three echoes. And we could configure that and triangulate that between the echoes to find that for one of the shots, the 862nd shot fired that night was fired from as close as 1 meter to one of the paramedics, Ashraf Abu Labda's position. And this is the moment where we hear the last sounds of him, his last voice, his final movements. So we really suggest that this is the shot that executed him. Another key part of our audio analysis was to confirm the witnesses as the survivors, as really the most reliable source of documentation for this event. In every key moment, we could corroborate what they said and how they explained the event, and including some very small details that we could hear and pick up. The movements of ambulance, someone tried to escape, we hear it on the recording. The use of specific weapons that happened much later, 2 hours later. So I really want to push that forward while I'm with you today, is that it took a year's worth of work for us to really, you know, corroborate those testimony, but they've been saying, those survivors have been saying this information all along. So we're trying to get them the audibility with this case. We want them to be heard, finally, as the most reliable narrators of this event, and to amplify their voices. And we see this time and time again. We also, together with Forensic Architecture, published our joint investigation into the killing of Hind Rajab. Again, Hind says it over and over again. The tank is next to me. They're firing at me. It took our work to show that, yes, the tank was 12 meters away. But she's not a tragic victim of war. She is a witness to the crimes being perpetrated against her. And we're trying to get Palestinians that audibility by listening so intensely
Hind
to these
crimes. Hind is a little 5-year-old, 6-year-old girl who was killed by an Israeli tank. Her whole family, her aunt and uncle and her cousins, who had already been killed in this car. And there's this Oscar-nominated documentary, The Voice of Hind Rajab, that tells her story. Following an internal military inquiry, the commanding officer, back to the killing of the Palestinian aid workers of the 14th Brigade, received a letter of reprimand for, quote, his overall responsibility for the incident. And the deputy commander of the Golani Reconnaissance Battalion involved in the incident was dismissed from his position due to, quote, his responsibilities as the field commander and for providing an incomplete and inaccurate report during the debrief, unquote. Quote, no criminal actions recommended by the inquiry. Lawrence, finally, as we only have a minute to go, if you can comment on this, and also your being able to figure out some of the names, if only the first names, of the Israeli shooters, the Israeli assassins.
Yeah, with the really limited resources we've had, you know, two phone calls to the Palestinian Red Crescent headquarters and one recording taken under extreme duress, we've been able to piece together this crime. There is no reason why the Israeli army, with all of its GPS coordinates, its drones in the sky, couldn't have done this internal investigation at a way higher resolution than we can have done. So we expect, you know, this is simply an obstruction of justice. It is a flagrant war crime to attack medics and to kill them from and execute them from meters away. And so we just do not find it adequate at all, the response to this crime.
Lawrence Abu Hamdan, director of Earshot, also Samaneh Moafi of Forensic Architecture, assistant director of research. We thank you so much for being with us. We'll link to your new report, Israeli Executions of Palestinian Aid Workers and Efforts to Conceal Evidence. Coming up, we speak to the Committee to Protect Journalists about the torture of Palestinian journalists in Israeli prisons. Stay with us. Choir, I call out to you. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We now turn to the treatment of Palestinian media workers held in Israeli prisons since October 2023. The Committee to Protect Journalists reviewed testimony and evidence from 59 Palestinian journalists, finding strikingly consistent reports of beatings, forced stress positions, sensory deprivation, sexual violence, including rape, starvation, and medical neglect while detained. The journalists lost an average of 52 pounds in Israeli prisons. Most of them were held under Israel's so-called administrative detention policy and were never charged with any crime.
The Committee to Protect Journalists recently released its findings in a report headlined, "We Returned from Hell." Palestinian journalists recount torture in Israeli prisons. This is part of the testimony of Palestinian photojournalist Shadi Abu Sido. He was detained in the notorious Deit Haman prison for over 100 days.
I was filming the suffering of people in Al-Shifa Medical Complex, and I am a civilian. He ordered me to take off all my clothes, so I did. Then he tied my hands behind my back immediately and said to me, "You will learn the meaning of journalism in Tel Aviv here." He tied my hands, blindfolded me, and the first thing he did when he finished was break a rib here. That was the welcome. After that, he made me sit for more than 10 hours in the cold. It was in March, more than 10 hours sitting naked in the winter. Not to mention that he would come and beat me with punches. And that was just the beginning, along with the verbal insults.
For more, we're joined by Sarah Kudal, Middle East and North Africa Regional Director at the Committee to Protect Journalists, joining us from Paris, from France. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sarah. Explain what you found.
Thank you, Amy. To be honest, this report was one of the most difficult reports to work on because you are listening to human beings who are describing inhuman conditions they had to face for months, and some of them for years. The scale of these testimonies point to something far beyond the isolated misconduct that Israel tries to convince the general public. Across 58 testimonies from the 59 journalists that we interviewed, they described reoccurring sets of abuse, from beating, starvation, sexual violence that even reached to actual rape in so many cases, and medical neglect directed at journalists because they are journalists and because of their work. This exposed a deliberate strategy by Israel to intimidate and silence journalists and destroy their ability to bear witness to what is happening in Gaza. Torture and abuse inside the Israeli prisons have been reported on for so many years, but the scale and the intensity of the abuse and torture since the beginning of the genocide in Gaza has increased and intensified.
And Sarah, could you tell us, have the Israeli authorities responded at all to your findings?
In a single case, they did respond to us, and the response was that they treat all prisoners under the international human law, and they investigate in any misconduct that happens inside the prisons. But when we sent them, when we sent our emails and messages to the Israeli prison facilities and to Itamar Ben-Gvir office and the ministry, they did not respond to any of the testimonies of the journalists that we interviewed.
And how many of these journalists remain in prison, Palestinian journalists?
Until today, we have 32. So until the day of publishing the report, there were 30 journalists who are still in prison. But as of today, we have still 32 journalists who are in prison. We were able to contact one of the journalists, a female journalist, through her lawyer. And she did report on being beaten and that she was abused inside the facilities. She also told us, or she told her lawyer, and her lawyer told us that she did submit a complaint regarding the abuse and the torture. And in return of her complaint, she was put in confinement, in solidarity confinement.
And we wanted to continue by looking at your other report. The Committee to Protect Journalists has found a record 129 press workers were killed worldwide last year. The Israeli military was responsible for two-thirds of all press killings worldwide due to attacks on journalists in Gaza, in Yemen, and Iran. More journalists and media workers were killed last year than in any of the previous three decades for which CPJ has collected data. And the previous record was set just the year before, in 2024. The number of journalists killed in Sudan and Ukraine also rose.
But journalists were not only killed in conflict zones. CPJ documented journalists killed in Bangladesh, Colombia, Guatemala, Honduras, India, Mexico, Nepal, Peru, the Philippines, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia as well. They were targeted often for their reporting on corruption and crime. According to CPJ, there have been very few transparent investigations, and no one has been held accountable for these deaths. Sarah Kudal, if you could talk about the wider findings of this a CPJ report.
100%. To start with, because the biggest number of journalists being targeted and killed It was in Israel. This shows the systematic pattern that Israel is using to silence the journalists, whether by killing them, targeting them, imprisoning them, intimidating them, and also smearing them. So this is in the context of Israel. Worldwide, we see that the journalists are being targeted because of their work. It is now the most dangerous time for journalists to work since we started documenting in 1992. This tells us that this profession is becoming a very dangerous profession, and journalists might be killed just because they are trying to convey the truth for everyone in the world. We have in this report, we have documented even new patterns of targeting the journalists. We documented using the drones, and it is a very high technology, sophisticated technology to target civilians. It was widely used in Israel, where at least 28 journalists were killed in Israel by drones. It was also used in Sudan widely by the RSF, used in Ukraine by the Russian military, where they killed 4 journalists in Ukraine, targeted by drones. It was also used in single incidents, once in Yemen and once in Iraq. So we can see that there's a new global trend in targeting journalists. Also, the smearing. We have seen that Israel used the smearing campaigns as a tool to target the journalists or justify killing them after they killed them. In so many incidents, in 2025, journalists have been smeared for months, some of them for years. Like Anas Sharif, who was killed in August 2025, he was smeared months before he was killed because of his reporting on starvation and mass killing in Gaza. And then he was killed after being smeared. Other journalists were killed, and after they were killed, the Israeli authorities and the IDF said that they are terrorists and we targeted them because they are terrorists. So we are seeing that this smearing is being used to justify killings and to target killings with full impunity, with no accountability or justice. Also crimes, organized crimes. In Mexico, per se, few journalists were targeted and killed because they were trying to expose corruption inside the country. And because of that, they were killed. So we can see now that the journalists are not only being killed by military or governments, they are also killed by organized crimes. And this is something very alarming for us at the CPJ. And as the report mentioned, few investigations happened, and no one was ever held to account to these killings.
And so, Sarah, obviously you documented the killing of journalists in active war zones like Sudan, Ukraine, and Gaza. But you just mentioned Mexico. But in addition to Mexico, Saudi Arabia, Colombia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, can you tell us, are these killings that are mostly carried out by the state or by...
No. Mm-hmm. Mostly by the state, some of them by organized crime groups, but mostly by the states. In Saudi Arabia, since you mentioned Saudi Arabia, the journalist who was killed is Turkil Jasser. He is a prominent journalist who was imprisoned 4 years before he was charged with the death sentence, and then he was hanged and killed last year, unfortunately, by the Saudi Arabia government. In Yemen, the journalist who was killed by the Houthi army, which is a terrorist group, a terrorist designed group.
Sarah Kudal, we want to thank you very much for being with us, Middle East and North Africa Regional Director at the Committee to Protect Journalists. We'll link to both of CPJ's reports, record 129 press members killed in 2025, Israel responsible for 2/3 of deaths, and we'll link to your report, We Returned from Hell, Palestinian Journalists Recount Torture in Israeli Prisons. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Nicole Salazar, Sarah Nasser, Trina Nadura, Tamir Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Safwat Nizal, Sam Alkoff, our executive director, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Karl Marxer, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
Thank you. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM Radio. Burnaby.
With Canada's health system under strain, going digital can help heal our healthcare. From virtual visits for everyday concerns to faster, more accurate diagnostics powered by AI, technology is transforming care. Digital Health Canada supports the people and innovations behind this change. Learn more at digitalhealthcanada.com and subscribe to our podcast.
What is going on?